Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. 2015 was a year of increasing repression across much of Africa, according to the annual report from Human Rights Watch. The group says many African countries, especially in East and Central Africa, imposed new restrictions or pressure on opponents, journalists, rights activists, often to meet electoral goals. This is the group's executive director, Kenneth Roth.
What we've noticed over the last year in particular is that the autocrats of the world, the authoritarian governments, are running scared in the face of civil society. This has become particularly acute now that civil society has been empowered by social media, particularly social media on a mobile phone. Because what that means is that it is much easier for civic groups to mobilize large numbers of people on the street in order to protest governmental policy.
You can read more details on that story at voanews.com. The UN envoy to Libya warned Wednesday that the political process in the country's parliament is taking too long, which would allow for the further expansion of the Islamic State group in the region. This is Martin Kobler, the UN envoy to Libya.
I urge the respect, and here I have the authority of the Security Council of the United Nations behind me. I urge the respect for the stipulations of the agreement. And it says if there are changes, if some things cannot be accepted, there is a mechanism in place.
On Monday, Libya's House of Representatives voted against the unity government proposed under a peace deal, giving rivals 10 days to come up with a new, smaller cabinet. VOA News. The final round of presidential elections in the Central African Republic, which had been scheduled for Sunday, has been postponed over organizational problems, according to the Electoral Authority Wednesday. A senior official at the Electoral Authority said, "We can't hold the election on Sunday. It's impossible. We will soon announce a new date." There's been no official confirmation of that date, however. The United States and China have reaffirmed their commitment to denuclearized Korean Peninsula, but have not agreed on a new set of penalties after North Korea's recent nuclear test. After meeting in Beijing Wednesday with the Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said the two countries have made cooperative progress on issues such as climate change, but remain divided on how to deal with North Korea.
We look forward to working with China, which China agreed today to do, to engage in an accelerated effort at the United Nations, instructing both of our representatives to work together to try to achieve an understanding about the strong resolution that introduces significant new measures to curtail North Korea's ability to advance its prescribed nuclear and ballistic missile programs.
Meanwhile, the Chinese foreign minister said Wednesday his country was prepared to support a new UN resolution against Pyongyang's nuclear program. Hundreds of migrants and refugees continue to arrive daily in the Greek island of Lesbos, and volunteers say they're already perilous journeys are being made even less safe by substandard life jackets. According to volunteers, many of the life jackets purchased by migrants in Turkey, including vests for children, are made from very cheap materials and should not be used at sea. Irish volunteer Amy cut open a jacket to show the cheap plastic packaging used to fill many of the jackets discarded by the latest arrivals.
These are life jackets that are made in Turkey. They're made for very cheap, and they're made with layers of packaging that you would use to package maybe a television or maybe something fragile like glass, but not human life.
U.S. President Barack Obama has called for faster research on the quick-moving Zika virus, which is spread by mosquitoes and has been linked to a rise in birth defects in Brazil. Obama Tuesday urged better diagnostic tests and the development of vaccines and treatments against the virus. President Obama's latest actions come as health officials in Denmark said Wednesday that a resident who had traveled to South and Central America had tested positive for the Zika virus. As of now, there's no vaccine or medicine to treat the virus and no way to prevent it. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yves Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
During the Nairobi launch of the 2016 Human Rights Watch Global Report, HRW Africa Director Daniel Bekele said poverty, unemployment, massive population growth, bad governance, and weak institutions continue to set the stage for widespread human rights abuses.
That's VOA's Jill Craig reporting from Nairobi. Details next.
Also, a new report on global freedom names Africa as the world's most volatile region, and Cameroon closes most of its northern markets on the border with Nigeria.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Uganda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Human Rights Watch released its 2016 global report today, reviewing human rights practices in more than 90 countries from the end of 2014 through November 2015. For the organization's Nairobi launch, Somalia and Kenya researchers remarked on their findings in those East African nations. VOA's Jill Craig has more.
During the Nairobi launch of the 2016 Human Rights Watch Global Report, HRW Africa Director Daniel Bekele said poverty, unemployment, massive population growth, bad governance, and weak institutions continue to set the stage for widespread human rights abuses. But the politics of fear is the topic of this year's report, and Bekele highlighted the increasing number of small to large-scale armored violent conflicts in the region. Bekele said extremists, including fundamentalist groups Boko Haram, Al-Shabaab, and Al-Qaeda, are responsible for much of the violence, committing senseless killings, horrible abuses, and atrocities.
What is an equally worrying trend is how much the security forces' response to the security threat is increasingly downplaying, and in some cases probably totally abandoning human rights. And how much security forces' response that is riddled with abuses is actually, you know, sort of contributing to a cycle of abuses.
Arguing that this tenuous security situation may be tied to the intensification of political repression in a number of African countries, Bekele said some governments are adopting what he called a do-whatever-it-takes mentality in restricting freedom of expression and association.
We have seen a spike on attack on journalists, human rights defenders, and political opponents, and overall, you know, sort of like a very heavy crackdown on protests as well.
Bekele also highlighted the concern that Western countries and authoritarian regimes seem to be forming alliances in the face of these security threats.
And Western countries that have traditionally been strong on promoting, protecting, and defending human rights have shown alliance with authoritarian regimes in clamping down on civil and political space.
HRW's Somalia researcher Letitia Bader said that Somalia developed some key policies in 2015 pertaining to sexual and gender-based violence and the country's widespread internally displaced population, but that those policies have not been implemented, and therefore there have been no real changes on the ground. She also mentioned an uptick in fighting in the country due to the ongoing military operation against Al-Shabaab, but also in the drive to establish federal states in Somalia.
So who is able to get a seat at the negotiating table in Somalia in the creation of federalism has often been at a significant consequence to civilians on the ground.
Otsieno Namwaya, HRW's Kenya researcher, highlighted an increase in Al-Shabaab attacks in Kenya, primarily on unarmed civilians.
However, what has really worried us is the response of the Kenyan authorities to the attacks by the Al-Shabaab. The KDF, the Kenya police, that's the regular police, and the anti-terror police, and the GSU, a combination of all these units, have been implicated in a wide range of abuses at the coast in northeastern Kenya and in Nairobi.
But in spite of these negative findings, HRW did cite some improvements on the continent, such as peaceful elections in Nigeria and Botswana, progress in the expansion of economies and socioeconomic services in some African countries, and an increased awareness of maternal mortality and child marriage as rights issues. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Every year since 1973, Freedom House, a New York-based NGO, has tracked the state of civil liberties and political rights throughout the world. Its 2016 Freedom in the World report assesses conditions in 210 countries. Jennifer Dunham is Freedom House's director of research. She told VOA's Adam Phillips that once again, Africa was the most volatile region in the world.
Well, one of the main reasons that Africa was the most volatile region was moves by certain leaders to either manipulate term limits or extend the constitutional limits for presidential terms. The main example of this is in Burundi, where Nkurunziza's decision to run for a third term sparked both civil unrest, a failed coup, and ongoing political violence. It also led to the shutdown of almost all of the independent media in that country, which is incredibly concerning for us. For example, in Burundi, there was an agreement that ended the civil war about 10 years ago, the Arusha Accords, where he agreed not to do this. In Congo Republic, the president engineered an October constitutional referendum that allowed him to forego term limits and extend his rule to 2016. We also saw in neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo the beginnings of President Kabila trying to maneuver to find ways to extend his term, although his proposal to amend the Constitution was met with very serious protests back in January.
Can you tell me if these were done according to constitutional law? And if so, why is this an abridgment, per se, of political rights or civil liberties?
In general, it's considered to be best practice for there to be limits on a ruler's stay in office. So when we see presidents trying to extend their rule and become essentially rulers for life, that's a very disturbing development, and often they happen in the context of very repressive regimes who have already moved against the opposition and independent media, civil society, to kind of quash dissent in advance of any type of constitutional referendum that might be held.
So was there any positive signs in terms of the elections?
Yes, I'm happy to report. For example, the elections in Nigeria were seen as a very positive step for Nigeria. It was the first time that the opposition had won an election at the national level and the first time that the presidency had changed hands peacefully. We saw some problems with the Nigerian elections. It wasn't a great election, but it was definitely much better than the previous elections in terms of conduct by the Electoral Commission, as well as there was a lot less violence this time than there was last time. And we've seen some encouraging signs so far from President Buhari, but we're still waiting to see how he does in the fight against Boko Haram and in the fight against corruption, which were the two main platforms that he ran on. But Nigeria, their security forces are notorious for violating the human rights of detainees and indiscriminate killings and things like that. It is often under the cloak of anti-terrorism, and that's why they've been getting away with it. But we'll see how Buhari does. His pledge to wipe out Boko Haram was a very ambitious pledge. So we really hope that groups continue to press the government to not only help with the problem of Boko Haram, but also to get the security forces in line.
What about Kenya?
Kenya continued to see attacks by al-Shabaab in 2015, and its security forces continued to crack down in an indiscriminate way, including extrajudicial killings, disappearances, and also they've been harassing non-governmental organizations in attempts to deregister these organizations, as they've been also targeting media outlets and attempting to pass more restrictive laws regarding what the media can publish and things like that.
I understand that Ethiopia had a very difficult year in terms of this balance between anti-terrorism and human liberties.
With Ethiopia, what was really concerning this year was their crackdown on the Oromo protests. The Oromo population is one of the biggest ethnic groups in Ethiopia, and the Ethiopian government is expanding the land around the capital, Addis Ababa, and they are essentially taking Oromo land to do this, and the Oromo are protesting. And in response, the Ethiopian government is cracking down very severely on these protesters.
In the name of terrorism?
Well, they're using anti-terror laws that are on the books to crack down, but it's obvious that the Oromo protesters are not terrorists. They're merely just trying to protect their land.
That was Jennifer Dunham, Director of Research for Freedom House. She spoke with the VOA's Adam Phillips in New York.
Cameroon has closed most of its northern markets on the border with Nigeria. The action was taken after a series of bomb attacks Monday left at least 35 people dead and 70 wounded in the town of Bodo. Government spokesperson Issa Choroma Bakari says it was the 30th attack by suspected Boko Haram militants on Cameroon since the start of the new year. Moki Edwin Kinzaga reports from Yaoundé.
Businessman Inusa Yege says shock and consternation has gripped the town of Bodo, where Monday's attack took place. He says it will take time for them to recover in spite of the heavy deployment of troops. The 33-year-old says the decision by the government to close all border markets in their locality may backfire, especially now that Boko Haram fighters are recruiting young people to steal and seize money and goods from farmers and traders.
Aujourd'hui, quand vous arrivez au marché, les boutiques sont vides. Les commerçants n'ont plus de l'argent pour.
He says traders are becoming poorer because all their shops have been sealed. He says youths who use commercial motorcycles to transport goods and people from the market to supply towns in Nigeria no longer have jobs, and they may now be tempted to join Boko Haram fighters who promise them better lives. Mijiyawa Bakari, the governor of the far north region of Cameroon, says the decision to close markets on Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria until further notice was taken for security reasons because the four female suicide bombers who attacked Bodo were disguised as traders and hid explosives in bags of vegetables they pretended to sell.
The decisions have been taken to close some market in the border, but people are persisting to go to sell and to buy things. You know that Boko Haram is looking where people are gathering to do this and that.
After Monday's attack, Cameroon soldiers launched raids on the Nigerian town of Ashigashia from where they believe the suicide bombers came. Cameroon's spokesperson, Issa Choroma Bakari, says 17 insurgents were killed in the operation. He says Cameroon has counted at least 30 attacks on its territory this year.
Faced with such harassment, both ungrounded and unjustified, our defense and security forces have always retaliated, leading the enemy to incur serious setbacks that have considerably weakened the group and reduced it to mere acts of cowardice, especially suicide bombings, which have become its modus operandi.
In Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé, groups of people have been visiting and sympathizing with Bodo's elite. Ngufo Jacob, leader of Cameroon's University Students Association, says that by visiting with people from Bodo, his group shows solidarity with Cameroon and Nigerian forces fighting Boko Haram terrorism.
I came out to show solidarity with my brothers and sisters in the north who are suffering from the onslaught of the Boko Haram insurgents. I came out also to show to the military that we are one, we are together. We may not have guns to join them in the north, but they should know that we have them at heart, we are praying for them, we are supporting them.
Cameroon believes the militants have resorted to attacking mosques, markets, churches and palaces of traditional rulers because the terrorist group's firepower has been drastically reduced following attacks on their strongholds within the past 2 months by Cameroon and Nigerian troops. Boko Haram's 6-year insurgency has killed more than 20,000 people and displaced close to 2.3 million, according to Amnesty International and the United Nations. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Also, Nigerian villagers living on the border with Cameroon have accused Cameroon's military of killing about 40 of their neighbors Monday. Residents of Guadela say Cameroon troops crossing the border to pursue Boko Haram militants shot and killed the villagers. There have been several other complaints in recent weeks that Cameroon soldiers have killed the Nigerian civilians while in pursuit of Boko Haram.
Nigeria is on edge over an outbreak of Lassa fever. Health officials have confirmed only 57 cases of the disease, but more than half of those individuals have died. Chris Stein reports with Ibrahima Yukoba in Kaduna and Ardo Hazard in Bauchi, Nigeria.
Nigeria's health ministry says 34 people have died from Lassa fever since the outbreak began in the north late last year. Lagos reported its first case earlier this month, and the disease has spread further south to Edo and Akwa Ibom states. In its early stages, symptoms include headache and fever. In later stages, the symptoms can include bleeding from the mouth and other orifices. The symptoms are similar to those of the Ebola virus. Both Ebola and Lassa are considered hemorrhagic fevers. The Ebola outbreak in West Africa that began in late 2013 killed over 11,000 people, including 8 in Nigeria. Lassa is transmitted through contact with rat excrement. Hassan Garba, a hospital director in the northern city of Bauchi, says rodents are easily able to travel across Nigeria.
So when you're moving food material like grains from the north to the south or to the east or to the west of the country, you most probably may be moving with rats.
That's prompted a spike in people buying rat poison. Adamu Abubakar is a shopper in the city of Kaduna.
This fever brought by rat. So that is why I'm rushing to the market and I buy rat medicine in order to kill all the rat that is in my house.
Merchants like Odundele Benga say they can't keep up with the demand.
In fact, people are rushing the rat poison now. I don't even have enough to sell for now.
Health authorities caution that rat poison is itself toxic and should be used with care. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
Human Rights Watch Executive Director Kenneth Roth has scolded Europe and the United States for their treatment of migrants from the Near East and Africa. He says government policies are, in his words, blatant Islamophobia and shameless demonizing of refugees. HRW's annual report is being unveiled today in Istanbul. Turkey is now home to 2.2 million Syrian refugees and the point of departure for most migrants fleeing to Europe. Roth writes in the report that Western reaction to the migrant crisis is the kind of division and animosity that terrorist recruiters love to exploit.
Meanwhile, European countries are speeding up deportations. Greek migration minister Ioannis Mouzalis says today screening centers in the Greek islands could process and send back to Turkey within 24 hours thousands who do not qualify for refugee status. In Germany, the parliament is considering a bill to immediately deport foreigners convicted of homicide, bodily harm, sexual assault, violent theft, serial shoplifting, and youth convicted of crimes. The Greek Coast Guard today recovered the bodies of 7 migrants, 2 children, and 5 adults who drowned when their boat sank today off the Greek island of Kos. 2 survivors were rescued.
In the U.S., a federal judge has acquitted a 21-year-old American of 3 counts of sexually abusing children at a Nairobi, Kenya orphanage last year. The judge in Oklahoma City said prosecutors failed to prove Matthew Lane Durham had planned to travel to Kenya to abuse the children. However, the judge barred defense lawyers from appealing a jury decision in June on related charges. Durham was found guilty of 4 counts of sexually abusing several girls between the ages of 5 and 15 and a 12-year-old boy at Upendo Children's Home. Durham has not yet been sentenced on those convictions.
The World Health Organization says there has been a sharp increase in smoking by school-aged children in Zimbabwe. That's despite the fact that selling tobacco products to children is illegal there. The findings are part of the WHO's Global Youth Tobacco Survey released today. Sebastian Myofu reports from Harare.
The World Health Organization report released Wednesday in Harare revealed that 20% of adolescents in Zimbabwe are consumers of tobacco products. The Global Youth Tobacco Survey in Zimbabwe targeted youth between 13 and 17 years old. It was funded by the United States Center for Disease Control, CDC, and the World Health Organization. The WHO's Dr. Anderson Chimusoro urged the government to increase public awareness of the health issue.
The main worry is that this is almost equivalent to the results that we have in the demographic and health survey, which shows that 22% of adult population is estimated to be using tobacco products. I've got a number of issues that we think as WHO the country can take on board to help us in this issue. We propose that the government should promote and strengthen public awareness on tobacco control issues, including in schools.
The survey revealed that some youths smoke while on school premises. In Zimbabwe, smoking and selling tobacco products is prohibited among children under the age of 18. Public health specialist Shungu Munyati, who headed the research, said President Robert Mugabe's government must enforce laws on smoking if stamping out smoking among school-age youths is to be achieved. But she says since tobacco plays a role in Zimbabwe's economy, it might be a problem.
It's a conflict of interest. The argument has always been, yes, we are growing tobacco, but we are growing tobacco. It's not for our consumption. We are growing tobacco so that we can market it and sell it out there and have revenue for the country. But at the same time, if we're just growing and sending it out, fine, but we also manufacture the cigarettes here. There's a market. So it's a dilemma that is faced by Zimbabwe.
Tobacco is one of the cash crops that Zimbabwe's tattered economy is depending on for recovery. It contributes 8.5% of Zimbabwe's gross domestic product. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on the Voice of America. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to Africa News Tonight for the latest sports, features, and more coming up next right here on VOA. For the full hour of Africa News Tonight, tune in again at 1800 UTC.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the upcoming presidential runoff elections and parliamentary elections in the Central African Republic. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC when host Shaka Sali and his guests analyze the ballot. That's next time on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butter here to remind you that February is Black History Month here in the United States. And starting February 1st, we will begin our Black History Month series and daily quiz. Listen every morning as we profile historical African-American and African individuals and events. You can win a special Daybreak Africa calendar and other VOA goodies by answering one of our daily Black History questions. Please send your answers to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. You can also call us on 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. We will select a winner each morning from among the correct answers. Black men don't stop us. Don't forget.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Human Rights Watch releases its 2016 global report today, reviewing human rights practices in more than 90 countries. A 2016 Freedom in the World report assesses that once again, Africa was the most volatile region in the world. And Cameroon closes most of its northern markets on the border with Nigeria. Coming up, music from Uganda, and in our feature segment, Mozambicans fleeing fighting between Renamo rebels and government forces are seeking asylum in neighboring Malawi. I'm Kim Lewis with Yahya Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And, of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Wednesday, Sunny.
Happy Wednesday, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you're kicking off in Rwanda.
Kim, the field is now set for the quarterfinals at the fourth edition of the African Nations Championship football tournament in Rwanda. Remember, VOA football fans, this competition, also called CHAN, is for locally based players in Africa. Mali clinched the final berth Wednesday with a scoreless draw against Zambia in the capital, Kigali. The Zambians already had booked a place in the quarterfinals, and they topped Group D with 7 points from 3 matches. Mali had 5 points. In Wednesday's other match, played in Gisenyi, Rwanda, Uganda and Zimbabwe played to a 1-1 draw. Jeffrey Serunkuma scored a late equalizer for Uganda's Cranes after William Monondo scored Zimbabwe's first goal of the tournament in the 49th minute. In Group C results Tuesday, Tunisia and Guinea advanced to the last 8 with victories. Tunisia trounced Niger 5-0 in Kigali, while Guinea edged Nigeria 1-0 in Gisenyi. Our African football guru, David Legg, says he's surprised the Super Eagles of Nigeria didn't make it to the quarterfinals.
Yes, Sonny, a big, big turn up here in Group C. I would have put quite a few dollars on Nigeria qualifying. I also felt Guinea as debutants would make some impression, but I certainly did not see them finishing above Nigeria. Nigeria were well-placed, Sonny, going into the final round of matches. They had 4 points. Tunisia and Guinea had 2 each, and Niger had just 1. So for Nigeria, it was a question of not losing. If they got a win, great, but even a draw would have seen them through. But they just did not play well. And on the stroke of half-time, they fell behind when Sankon scored from the edge of the 6-yard box. I really thought the Nigerians would throw everything, including the proverbial kitchen sink, at the Guineans in the second half, but it didn't turn out that way. The Guineans, a nice short passing game. They remained calm. They defended well. Nigeria really only had a couple of chances late in the second half. Onyedikachi had a volley from close range, well parried by the Guinean goalkeeper. And just after that, a Nigerian shot from outside the box flashed just wide. It was one of those shots that could have gone anywhere. If it had gone into the net, it would have been one of the goals of the tournament. But the really standout statistic at the end of it all was that Nigeria had 11 goal attempts, but only 2 were on target. And that is simply not good enough for a team coming from a nation so proud about their football and determined to get back to the top of the African ladder. 2 shots on target. In other words, 1 shot on target every 45 minutes. Sunday Elise must have been disbelieving at the end. And somebody who just didn't shape up in this tournament was Adeniji. He came to Rwanda, highly rated as a striker, but didn't perform well. And then Olise, surprisingly, I thought, left Chikatara, the man who scored 4 goals in the previous 2 games, on the bench until the start of the second half. But when he came on, he made absolutely no impression, Sonny. He just wasn't the same player that had scored a hat-trick against Niger and also a goal against Tunisia. So Nigeria's sad tale at the CHAN continues. In 2009, they didn't even make the finals, eliminated by Ghana. In 2011, the same story, a shock defeat in the qualifiers by Niger. In 2014, they got to the semi-finals, a goalless draw with Ghana. They lost on penalties, finished third by beating Zimbabwe. And I believe that they were certainly among the top four candidates to win this CHAN competition in Rwanda. I had them up there with DR Congo, Morocco, and Tunisia. But on the performance against Guinea in Djeseni in the west of the country, they simply weren't good enough. They did not deserve to make the quarterfinals. But while the Nigerians just couldn't find the net in Kigali, 250 kilometers away, Tunisia were making hay while the sun shone against Niger, scoring five goals. And among those scorers was a brace for Big E and also one for Akachi, who's now with four goals, the joint top scorer with Chikatara in the competition. I like the look, Sonny, of these Tunisians. They're compact, they defend well, they're playing North African football at its best. And dare I say it, because forecasting in this competition is becoming rather hazardous, but I think we've got to watch out for the Tunisians. They look to me a side capable of going all the way. But then there are probably seven other teams who would say exactly the same.
David, can you give us an update on attendance and overall organization at Rwanda 2016?
I'm very pleased to say, Sonny, things are going swimmingly well. The Rwandans can be very proud. You know, we've mentioned previously on The Voice of America that President Paul Kagame had got personally involved. And my hunch from several months ago is that this tournament was going to be the most successful CHAN. And so far, Sonny, that's exactly what's happening. What is tremendous is to see thousands of Rwandans turning up to watch matches not involving their own side. Wherever you play a tournament in Africa, the home side will always get huge support. If the stadium holds 90,000 people will turn up invariably. But what suffers is, say, if you host a tournament in Nigeria and there's a match between Angola and Gabon, then sometimes just a couple of hundred people trickle into the stadium. Now, what the Rwandans did is they opened the gates in the sense that they are offering free admittance. And people, especially the youth, have turned up in droves. And it was great. For example, the match between Nigeria and Guinea in Gisenyi, in the northwest of the country, full house at the Umuganda Stadium. And it just makes such a difference. I mean, one tires of watching these African tournaments where you've got this morgue-like atmosphere with just a couple of spectators and a few officials, of course, they're always there in the main stands watching these games. So well done to the Rwandan. The organization, too, Sonny, it seems to be seamless. There's absolutely no problems, no dramas whatsoever. Obviously, still some time to go in the competitions. We're now entering the knockout stage, and that's, of course, when disputes over penalties and offsides, etc., can add to the drama of the occasion. But so far, Sonny, marks out of 10, I would give Rwanda a very good 9. I think they've been doing a superb job, and to me, of the four CHAN tournaments, this one is by far the best. And also with a tournament, besides organization and good support, what you want to see are goals. And we're seeing lots of them, Sonny. After Nigeria and Guinea and Tunisia and Niger matches, we had 60 goals in the competition so far in 22 games. And that's an average of 2.7. And the previous best, which was in South Africa 2 years ago, was 2.2. So they're well up on that. And if you look at the leading goal scorers, Akachi of Tunisia and Chikatara of Nigeria, they've got four goals each. And then quite a few players on two goals, including Harry Papel of Angola, Kamara of Guinea, Elia of DR Congo, Emane of Cameroon, Muyawi of Morocco, Sugira of Rwanda, and Bagir of Tunisia. And Sonny, I know you love your statistics, so I've been working extra hard, being very diligent. And what I can tell you is of those 60 goals, 45 have come from shots, 9 from headers, 2 from free kicks, 2 from penalties, 1 was a back heel, superb one from Akachi of Tunisia, and there was one unfortunate own goal that was scored by Kimwaki of DR Congo. And of further interest to you may well be, when are these goals coming? Well, the most goals, Sonny, I've divided each half into 3, have come in the final third of the first half, 31 to 45 minutes. We've had 15 goals in that period. And the best goal so far, in my opinion, It was Mouimi of Cameroon scoring against DR Congo, the second goal, a cross and a volley. If the goalkeeper had got in the way, I think he could have been in hospital right now. What a shot, a superb reaction. Sweetest volley I've seen in a long time. For me, so far, the goal of the tournament.
Speaking of goals, David, a Togolese star who scored more than a few over the years, Emmanuel Adebayor, has signed a short-term deal with Crystal Palace until the end of the English Premier League season. The 31-year-old Adebayor was available after being released by Tottenham Hotspurs in September 2015. Adebayor has extensive Premier League experience, having previously played for Manchester City and Arsenal. In a couple of other moves involving African players, Ghana and Chelsea winger Christian Atsu has joined Spanish club Malaga on loan until the end of the season. And Ivory Coast international Gervinho is going to China. He signed with the club Hebei China Fortune after 2.5 years with the Italian club Roma. Let's take a look at the quarterfinal matchups now at the African Nations Championship Tournament in Rwanda. There will be two quarterfinals on Saturday and two more on Sunday. In the first quarterfinal Saturday, Rwanda will host the Democratic Republic of Congo in the capital, Kigali. And that will be followed by a match between Cameroon and Ivory Coast in Butare, Rwanda. In the first quarterfinal on Sunday, Tunisia will take on Mali in Kigali. And that will be followed by a game between Zambia and Guinea in Gisenyi, Rwanda. The semifinals are scheduled for February 3rd and February 4th in Kigali. And the third-place match and final will also be played in the Rwandan capital on February 7th. Of the 8 teams still in contention for the trophy, only the DRC and Tunisia have lifted it in the past. The Congolese won the inaugural CHAN tournament in Ivory Coast in 2009, and the Tunisians won the next one, held in 2011 in Sudan. In National Basketball Association news, Los Angeles Clippers star Blake Griffin is expected to be sidelined up to 6 weeks with a broken right hand, his shooting hand, after he punched the club's equipment manager. Full details have not yet emerged, but Griffin already had a leg injury and he hadn't played in more than a month. Bad break for Blake Griffin and the Los Angeles Clippers. Got to keep your temper under control, Blake Griffin. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yeheis Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, Mozambicans fleeing fighting and seeking asylum in neighboring Malawi. And next, efforts to make nomadic tribes in South Sudan citizens. But first, some music. Here is Jose Chameleon from Uganda with Jamidia.
Yeah. Jamila ni mwambi ya panyeche Nidamupa kita na chakula akule Lakini mambo ya mapenzi na okupa Zamani mimi na yetu nishindana Nikapata muke, akapata bwana Sasa analia kamilio ni panyeche Jamila analia ni mwambi ya panyeche Jamila analia Wana wake ya memuacha Jamila analia
Uganda's Jose Chameleon with Jamila.
In Mozambique, the UN Refugee Agency says growing numbers of Mozambicans fleeing fighting between Renamo rebels and government forces are seeking asylum in neighboring Malawi. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency reports an almost unstoppable flow of refugees from Mozambique is crossing over the border into Malawi. The agency says its staff in the village of Kapise, about 100 kilometers south of the capital, Lilongwe, so far has registered nearly 1,300 new arrivals, with more than 900 people waiting to be recorded. It says another 400 people have arrived in 16 other villages. UNHCR spokeswoman Karen de Gruel says most of the refugees are women and children who come from Tete province in Mozambique. She says the refugees report fighting between the opposition Renamo and government forces is making life impossible in their home villages.
Refugee women told you, a UNHCR protection officer, how their homes were burned down with one elderly lady left inside to die. They say that government forces are attacking villages believed to be harboring opposition forces and opposition members. We have not been able, however, to confirm the accuracy of these allegations. Some parents also stated that they've been separated from their children during flight.
De Gruel says the UNHCR and government authorities in Malawi believe the fighting in Mozambique, which broke out in February last year, would be temporary. Therefore, she says, agreements were made with the national authorities for local communities to host some 700 Mozambican refugees who had arrived in mid-2015.
In the past few weeks, however, the situation has changed and more people are crossing into Malawi, and we have reports that more people are coming. Malaria is a major concern as there are not enough mosquito nets, and the number of patients seen daily has increased from 70 to 250 people.
De Gruul says several UN aid agencies, as well as the charity Doctors Without Borders, are in hand to help the refugees with food, non-food items and medical relief. She says the government of Malawi is considering reopening Luani refugee camp, which previously hosted refugees from Mozambique's long-running civil war. That war, which was waged between 1977 and 1992, prompted more than 1 million Mozambicans to flee to Malawi. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In South Sudan, the new Wau state governor, Elias Waya Niapak, wants the Falata nomads to be recognized as South Sudanese tribes. The Falata come from Nigeria but spend several months a year grazing their cattle in his state. The governor also wants other nomadic tribes to be recognized as South Sudanese citizens. Communities in Wau have mixed reactions to the Governor Waya's suggestion. Michael Atit has the story from Wau.
Governor Elias Waya Nipoj's suggestions that the Falata and those known as Greeks, because of their forefathers came from Greece, says the two communities deserve South Sudanese citizenship since their ancestors were born in South Sudan in the 19th century. Waya says he and many other leaders were taught by Falata teachers in Wau, and many of them have contributed to the development of this country in other ways. He says the Falata and Greek communities should be added to the list of 64 South Sudanese tribes.
They were born and raised up here with us, and now they have members in the National and State Assembly, but they are not counted among the 64 tribes. We have inherited the old Sudan with these entire groups, and now we are an independent country as South Sudan, so no one should be excluded from those tribes.
The Falata and Greek communities welcome the governor's suggestion, saying it will provide them with more opportunities. Yeni Mastrolis was born of a South Sudanese mother and a Greek father in Wau 60 years ago. He says his wife is from Wau, so he and his five kids are automatically South Sudanese by nationality.
We are South Sudanese because we were born from South Sudanese mothers. We know our fathers are from Greece, but they married from here, and we also married from here, and we produced children from here. Now we are citizens of South Sudan, so we are happy to hear from a top government official that we are a part of this country.
Yeni says, though Greeks came to South Sudan back in the early 19th century as traders and businessmen, members of his community often face several challenges while applying for national documents such as nationality identity card or passport. He says he tries several times to acquire a nationality card, but has yet to be issued one. 63-year-old Ali Ahmad is from the Falata community. He says his grandfather came to South Sudan from Nigeria several decades ago while going to Mecca in Saudi Arabia.
The Falata have intermarried with local communities like Zanda, Golo, Ndogo, and even Jur. And now our kids are big people, and they are holding major positions in the government.
Ahmad says it would be difficult for Falata descendants like him to return to their ancestors' homeland in Nigeria because no one knows them there. Another Falata man, Shuaib Muhammad, says if they are recognized as South Sudanese nationals, they can access opportunities and services like all other citizens. Muhammad, who has been a chief in Wau since 1983, says members of his communities are committed to developing South Sudan.
We are all one, and we don't need more segregation among communities. Let's all work for the development of this country. We are all South Sudanese.
50-year-old Elizabeth Bernardo Mboro, a mother of five, comes from South Sudan's Ndogo tribe and is married to a man of Greek origin. Mboro says she supports the idea of adding the Falata and the Greeks to the list of South Sudanese tribes, saying such a decision is long overdue.
These people are born here and they have intermarried with the locals. Why are they denied the nationality? I am upset that my children and I faced several questions at the migration office.
Article 45, sub-article 1 of the 2011 South Sudan Transitional Constitution states that every person born to a South Sudanese mother or father shall have an inalienable right to enjoy South Sudanese citizenship and nationality. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Wau.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanoff, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Democracy is critical to Africa's future. But if democracy is to take root and flourish, specific conditions must be met. Chief among these are free and fair elections. These, in turn, cannot take place if the voting public lacks access to information about important issues, or if voters are prevented from meeting with or rallying for their chosen candidates. In other words, freedom of speech and of the press and freedom of association are indispensable aspects of free elections and of democracy itself. That is why the United States is concerned about the deteriorating electoral environment in Uganda and the run-up to the presidential and parliamentary elections set to be held on February 18th. 8 candidates are vying for the presidency, including sitting president Yoweri Museveni, who first came to power in 1986 but was only elected into office in 1996. He is currently running for a 5th term in office. According to Human Rights Watch, Uganda's current election campaign is fraught with intimidation of journalists, including threats or warnings of possible repercussions for critical reporting, government harassment and intimidation of independent voices in the media and civil society, obstruction and dispersal by police of opposition rallies with excessive illegal arrests, beatings, and other use of force by security personnel. At least one member of a candidate's staff, opposition campaign aide Christopher Aini, has disappeared. For the sake of Uganda and all of its people, the upcoming elections must be free, fair, and transparent. The United States believes that for this to happen, all Ugandans must have the opportunity to exercise their right to assemble peacefully, express their opinions, and participate in the electoral process free from intimidation and abuse. They also depend on government institutions and security forces remaining neutral, defending the rights of all people and protecting all parties equally, wrote State Department spokesperson John Kirby in a statement. We call on the government, civil society, and political parties to do their part to ensure a peaceful, transparent, and credible electoral process.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the upcoming presidential runoff elections and parliamentary elections in the Central African Republic. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC when host Shaka Sali and his guests analyze the ballot. That's next time on VOA Africa.